I think they should use the word legal. Legal votes. They're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election.
The president can sue a ham sandwich. He can send 1,000 lawyers.
We have a lot of information coming and litigation that you'll see.
No collusion. There's no collusion after all of that, which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
Winning is easy. Losing is never easy. Not for me, it's not.
Come on. Don't be ridiculous. Networks don't get to decide elections. Courts do.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney, and a former federal prosecutor. He writes the Popehat Report, which you can subscribe to on Substack. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
It's our special end of 2020 episode, and thanks to all the listeners who sent in questions, we have a lot to get to and a special interview, so let's jump right in. So there was a completely nuts meeting at the White House on Friday night with the president and Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani and Michael Flynn and Pat Spillone, the White House counsel, and a number of other officials, in which Powell and Flynn and Giuliani were urging the president to do some crazy things. And apparently some of his other staff was urging him not to do those crazy things. So I guess, first of all, Powell, and remember, just a few weeks ago, the president's campaign had to issue a statement distancing itself from Sidney Powell, saying she's not the president's lawyer, she's practicing law out here on her own, whatever that means. But now Sidney Powell is in the White House urging the president to try to seize voting machines from the states so they can be inspected or something to look for some conspiracy to steal the election from him. And the president is talking about wanting to make her a special counsel in the White House and give her some sort of security clearance to oversee that sort of operation. So certainly that seems like a turn of events for Sidney Powell.
Yes. I mean, it's been clear for a while that she is one of the people that President Trump is listening to in this post-election season. You know, it's been reported that he's listening to fewer and fewer people. And unfortunately, the ones he does listen to are crazier and crazier, being people like Powell and Rudy Giuliani. But this seemed beyond the pale, even for the track record he's established. And you have some of his staff who are, frankly, already pretty far out there, being the ones who have to pull him back from the idea that, you know, he's going to issue an executive order seizing with the military, if necessary, state voting machines, which is not something he has the power to do, and which is a very alarming thing to suggest. Also, the suggestion of elevating Sidney Powell to some sort of government official lawyer, given her recent conduct, the bizarre nature and clearly false nature of many of the lawsuits that she's filed, the uniform rebuke of those lawsuits by every court to consider them, is also extremely alarming. It's really like the president deciding to pluck some crazy pro se person off the street and make them the shadow attorney general or something.
Ordinarily, a special counsel that's a position in the Justice Department. If there's a conflict of interest or something that means that an investigation or a prosecution can't be conducted through the ordinary channels, you appoint a special counsel, and the special counsel has certain regulatory protections that a regular prosecutor would not. And the president has been quite openly frustrated with the fact that the Justice Department hasn't appointed a special counsel to look into the election, hasn't appointed a special counsel to investigate Hunter Biden. Bill Barr, in his final days as Attorney General, made a public statement on Monday that if he thought a special counsel at this stage was the right tool and was appropriate, he would name one, but he hasn't and he's not going to, which surely is not going to make the president happy. But so this discussion of making Sidney Powell a special counsel within the White House, what does that even mean? Can you have a special counsel who's in the White House rather than the Justice Department?
Well, it certainly doesn't seem to fit the special counsel regulation, which would have the Attorney General, by the way, not the president, appointing the special counsel, as has happened in the past. Can the president make up new positions within the White House for advisors, some of whom are legal? Probably. But it's not clear how he could imbue that person with any powers. They wouldn't have the power to prosecute any cases, and they wouldn't have the authority to direct anything from any investigating agencies. So Sidney Powell by herself can file crazy lawsuits, but she can't get search warrants or issue grand jury subpoenas or anything like that. So even if he did this absent some truly extraordinary claim about the powers she would have, she would be mostly a figurehead making claims and statements about election fraud, but without the power actually to even have any investigators to use.
And so this idea of seizing voting machines, first of all, I'm not clear what they think that they would do with the voting machines, since the Electoral College has already cast its votes in this election. And as, you know, as Dominion's voting systems has pointed out, and later in the show, we're going to talk with Tom Clare, who's an attorney for Dominion, who's been threatening to sue Sidney Powell for defamation for all the claims that she's made about them allegedly trying to rig the election. You know, there were all these ballots. And in Georgia, for example, they had a hand recount of the ballots, which matched the count from the machines quite closely, so that, you know, that's your evidence that the machines weren't changing the votes. You looked at the paper trail; the paper trail said what it was supposed to. They've been looking for someone who would do this seizure, and the Department of Homeland Security says it has no authority to do that. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine if you even tried to do that. They're trying to conduct a runoff election in Georgia right now. I don't know how they would do that if those machines somehow came in possession of the federal government.
Well, sure. And in terms of what they're doing, I think they're just building their narrative. Because there have been hand recounts, it's not a situation where plausibly you're going to get the machines and pry them open and find some sort of sinister evidence of vote switching in with the wires or something like that. I think what they're doing is wanting to seize them so they can then proclaim, we've examined them and now determined that these are the ways that votes could have been switched, or this is the evidence we think upon examining them that shows that votes were falsified. And you have to understand that these people are completely okay with flat out lying and with putting on so-called expert declarations from crazy people and flat out liars. So I really think that the getting the voting machines in their hands is symbolic and narrative building. It's like Joe McCarthy's piece of paper. I have here in my hand a list of however many communists in the State Department. It's a way for them to push the narrative.
One of Michael Flynn's ideas is that the president should declare martial law and then use martial law in order to conduct a rerun of the presidential election. And a lot of people are alarmed by this suggestion and the news reporting that the president is taking the suggestion at least somewhat seriously. But I don't even understand what that means. I mean, suppose we wake up in the morning and Donald Trump has said, okay, now there's martial law. What would it even mean for the military to do anything in that regard? The military does not conduct elections. What would they be purporting to use powers to do?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you might have, under some circumstances, martial law to stop rioting or to take control of some place where there's been a disaster, stop looting. You might have martial law someplace where there's absolutely no law enforcement available. But you can't have martial law administer government functions. That's not what it does. You know, you don't have the martial law department of welfare, or the martial law department of the post office. There is no provision for the military to have any role in elections, thank God. And to their credit, some people in the military have said very upfront, we do not have a role in American elections.
We've talked a fair amount about what isn't sedition, and people throw around, you know, when people, for example, urge the president to reject the results of the election, try to hold on to office, they say that that's sedition. And sedition is a specific legal thing, in the same way that treason is a specific legal thing. And there's a lot of things that people colloquially say are treason that are not the criminal offense of treason. And so when you go on television and say that, you know, that this ought to happen, that's probably not sedition. What if you go into a meeting in the Oval Office and urge the president to use extra legal means to hold on to his power as president? Is that sedition? Are you then trying to foment a coup against the U.S. government?
Well, arguably, if you're asking him to use extra legal means, then yes. The question is, what for the president is an extra legal means? So the sedition statute requires a conspiracy to overthrow, put down, or destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war against them, or to oppose by force the authority of them. So one side would argue that's exactly what he's doing. He's trying to get the president to overthrow the government with the military. And the other side would say, no, the president can, under some circumstances, declare martial law. He's advocating for a broad use of presidential powers, an aggressive use of presidential powers. It would be the government doing this, not the government being overthrown. So it's not as easy as just saying this is crazy. You know, that's not what the military does.
But if he's urging the president to do any of those things after noon on January 20th, then that's not the government anymore. Joe Biden is the rightful president after that point. So wouldn't that be an overthrow? The president has, there are circumstances in which the president can impose martial law, but there is no circumstance in which Donald Trump can impose martial law after noon on January 20th.
Yes, I'd agree with you on that. After that, there's no plausible argument that he's urging the government to exercise powers. He's then urging the overthrow of the government by someone who no longer has power. But, you know, sedition, Josh, is one of those words like treason that is constantly overused in a very feelings-based way. We use it as shorthand for something that is, terrible, immoral, and against American values. And it does have actual meaning.
I guess you're saying that conceivably could be an area of legal exposure for Michael Flynn, depending on exactly what he urged the president to do. And so that might be something the president needs to do a little cleanup with an additional pardon for Flynn on top of the pretty sweeping pardon he's already given him.
I think that actually, based on what's been reported, it would be very hard to make a sedition case against Michael Flynn, given the argument that he simply advocating for a use of current government power or an expansion of current government power. I don't think it's a good sedition case. If he kept doing it after Trump leads power, as you suggest, that might be a good sedition case.
Regarding Sidney Powell and the possibility that she will become a White House employee, we're going to talk later in the show about the possibility that she has legal exposure for having defamed various entities, including these voting machine companies. If Powell becomes a government employee, does she then have protection from the Westfall Act and the Federal Tort Claims Act in the way that the president may be protected when he is sued by E. Jean Carroll for defamation? That, you know, if she starts making these defamatory claims or these allegedly defamatory claims in her government capacity, does that relieve her of personal liability for defamation that she might commit?
Yes, it theoretically would. It wouldn't reach back in time to cover all the things she's already said, which are quite enough to establish liability. But it could conceivably cover the things she says that are in the scope of her job. And if her job is to be this free-floating election fraud investigator, then that would cover a very broad range of speech related to that subject. So her new speech in that capacity would probably be covered by those acts.
One thing we've talked about with the possibility of special counsels in the Justice Department is the difficulty that Joe Biden or Joe Biden's attorney general would have dismissing those special counsels. You're only supposed to do that for certain reasons by regulation. There are also significant political difficulties with trying to dismiss a special counsel. But if Sidney Powell is sort of a fake special counsel in the White House, Biden has no she's just fired at noon on January 20th, right? There's no reason that Biden would have to retain her there doing her crazy.
Exactly. Unless Trump got Bill Barr to appoint her through the special counsel regulations and cloak her with that protection, then she's just someone who can be fired automatically. And Bill Barr shows no indication that he's willing to do that. And indeed, at this point, only has a couple of days in which he could.
Well, but his successor as acting attorney general could conceivably do that.
Conceivably,
not
yes.
That he would.
Right. We don't have any indication yet that he's willing to go that far, but he could conceivably.
Well, and also you can terminate a special counsel for certain kinds of misconduct. And I assume it would be likely that Powell would meet that bar given her antics.
Yes. But of course, I think what, you know, these are all angels dancing on the heads of pins, Josh, because it's all very hypothetical. But I would think that appointing her would be a gesture that it's not so much to have a substantive result where she does an actual investigation and there's a result that affects the election. I think it's just another wrench thrown into the gears of Biden's presidency. It's one more distraction. It's one more thing where if he does fire her for cause or otherwise, then it's a big controversy in a news cycle. Maybe Congress gets involved, the Republicans and the Senate get involved, and so forth. It's a way to cause havoc.
we'll see. I may regret saying this. I don't think she's going to end up at DOJ. Let's talk about Elliot Broidy. The former top Trump fundraiser is under indictment for conspiring with a number of people, including a member of the Fugees, to illegally lobby on behalf of a Malaysian government official who was involved in the massive 1MDB investment fund fraud. Broidy is accused of trying unsuccessfully, I would note, to get the Justice Department under President Trump to stop pursuing the 1MDB investigation. So, Ken, it seems that Broidy got in trouble in part because he voluntarily shared his electronic devices with the FBI because he was hacked by a state actor that was hostile to another one of his clients. So if you're doing crimes, should you give your electronic devices to the FBI because of a dispute that you're having in the course of your business?
F***ing clients. You see, this is the thing, Josh. This is the thing. The U.S. Attorney's Office has such a great trial win record and they get so many guilty pleas. Is it because they're such fantastic lawyers? No. It's because so many people are so incredibly stupid. And this is a great example. If you're doing crimes, don't give your emails about the crimes to criminal investigators. This should be simple. But the problem is many people completely compartmentalize the way they think about things. They put the crimes in one box and then, oh, I've been hacked. That's in this other box over here. And it doesn't even occur to them that they're giving over this evidence. It's the same reason that people think they can talk to the FBI and talk them out of pursuing an investigation. It's classic human frailty. And no, it's to answer your question, it is a very bad idea to let the government see your emails if you have been criming.
Okay. So that's a helpful tip. I mean, don't crime is obviously the first piece of advice.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm realistic, Josh. just if you must crime, please be discreet.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Sidney Powell's election-stealing conspiracy theory involving two companies that make election equipment and software. Tom Clare, an attorney representing one of those companies, will join us after the break. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Sidney Powell has been out there alleging a wide-ranging conspiracy to steal the election from Donald Trump involving two companies that make election equipment and software: Dominion Voting Systems, which provides voting technology to a number of key swing states in this election, and Smartmatic, which doesn't. Smartmatic's only client in the United States for the 2020 election was Los Angeles County. Dominion and Smartmatic are competitors, but Powell has alleged that they're part of a conspiracy to rig elections set in motion by the late Hugo Chavez. And now both of those companies are pushing back. Smartmatic sent a letter to Fox News, One American News, and Newsmax demanding that they retract conspiracy claims made on their air. And Fox News sort of did that, running a very strange segment on shows hosted by Lou Dobbs and Maria Bartiromo, explaining why the allegations against Smartmatic are baseless and don't make sense. Dominion, meanwhile, has sent a letter to Kraken lawyer Sidney Powell, demanding that she retract her statements about Dominion and preserve documents related to her communications in the event that Dominion sues her for defamation. We're joined now by an author of that letter, an attorney representing Dominion Voting Systems. Tom Clare is with us. He is a partner at Clare Lock LLP. Hello, Tom.
Hi. It's great to be with you.
So I guess to get this out of the way, did Dominion Voting Systems participate in a wide-ranging conspiracy to change votes and steal this election from Donald Trump?
Absolutely not. I mean, the allegations that have been made and unfortunately spread way beyond what the value is are absolutely false. And Dominion is in the process of taking these legal steps, some of which you've alluded to, some of which are still to come, in order to set the record straight on exactly that point.
What are Dominion's damages if it has been defamed here? Has the company lost business because of this?
Well, certainly you can imagine when these sorts of allegations are made, however crazy they are, that it impacts relationships with customers. And because Dominion is in the voting equipment business, that their business is cyclical. And with state legislatures opening up after the first of the year and deciding on contracts and issuing RFPs for the next election cycle, these allegations are coming at a particularly critical time with the business cycle. And they have absolutely had frayed relationship with customers. We have actual economic damages that we can point to that relate specifically to these allegations. Fortunately, in our system, our legal system, that Dominion can recover for reputational harm, damage to its reputation. Regardless of what happens, Dominion is forever going to be branded on the internet with these crazy allegations.
If Dominion is a public figure, if you're going to prove defamation, then in addition to showing that what Sidney Powell is saying about your client is false, you'd have to show that she either made these allegations knowing that they're false or with reckless disregard for the truth. So first of all, is Dominion a public figure?
So I wouldn't necessarily concede that, but for purposes of the legal analysis, we assume that we're going to have to prove that actual malice, either because a court could conclude that they are a public figure by virtue of their role in public elections. Of course, that, you know, understand that argument could be made. But we're also very interested in punitive damages here. And under our system, in order to recover punitive damages, we're going to have to meet that actual malice standard anyway. And there's no shortage of evidence that would support that these statements were made with actual malice. I mean, there is the fact that these statements were made with a preconceived narrative. She was talking about voting machine fraud and irregularities even before the election had occurred. There's her reliance on sources that have been discredited, and just the fact that some of the stuff is just made up from whole cloth. It's hard to imagine a more reckless and irresponsible thing than something that is completely fabricated. And obviously, as the courts around the country have continued to rule on the fantastical nature of these allegations, her state of mind about making these statements surely satisfies that standard. So we're prepared to meet the actual malice standard.
I thought it was interesting. You also say that her status as a lawyer augurs in your favor here, because she has professional responsibilities that she is failing, either if she says these things knowing that they're false or if she fails to investigate them and realize their obvious falsity. I just thought that was interesting because we've seen so much poor behavior by lawyers over the last few years. It's just interesting to see a reminder that there are things that actually come with the law license.
If you're going to hold yourself out to the public as a lawyer and you're going to speak on behalf of somebody as a lawyer or identify yourself as a lawyer, you're trying to generate additional credibility for your statement. So you have to take the professional standards along with it. And if you fail to comply with your professional standards, that's something that certainly bears on the actual malice analysis.
As you noted, these allegations that Sidney Powell has made have been widely propagated by other political actors and then also by various media entities. So it seems to me like there are a lot of entities that Dominion might think about suing for defamation. Have you sent other letters like this one that you sent to Sidney Powell to other people who've been making statements about Dominion?
We have, yes. We are we're being careful and we're being deliberate, and we're looking specifically at you know, each person or entity or media outlet's conduct. So we're being careful and we're being driven by, you know, the evidence and what these folks have said. But the answer is yes, we are looking at everyone who has played a role in either saying these things themselves. And there certainly are people beyond Sidney Powell that have said these same allegations in their own voice and have stood behind it, but also the outlets that have recklessly, in our view, given a platform to them.
A consideration that I think often weighs on people, but especially corporations that are in a position like this where they feel they've been defamed, is that if they litigate, that's just going to draw more attention to the allegations. And especially if the issue is that the allegations have damaged your reputation, then drawing more people's attention to the allegations and keeping them in the press for longer can just enhance that damage. It's commonly referred to as the Streisand effect, where Barbara Streisand sued to try to stop publication of a photo of her house, causing the photo to be published all over the place. Have you and your client thought about that? Is it just that these allegations have been so widely disseminated that there's not good reason to worry more about more people learning because so many have already learned?
Well, I certainly can't get into privileged communications that I've had with the client, but your point is an excellent one, and it's certainly a conversation that comes up in every engagement that I have where we're talking about the considering defamation litigation. It's absolutely a consideration, but here the company has no other choice. It has been so broadly attacked, and these crazy and false allegations have been so widely attached to the name of the company that the expectation is, if these allegations are false, as they are, that the company will fight back. And many people, whether it's clients or customers or just people in the real world, have appropriately said, if these allegations are false, then you should fight back. And that's exactly what the company is going to have to do. So the way I look at it and typically counsel clients is, if you're in this situation where you have no choice, it's brand defining as these allegations are, then the only way you can set the record straight is to take this action that our legal system affords of filing a defamation suit to set the record straight.
Tom, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us. Tom Clare is representing Dominion, and he's partner at Clare Locke LLP. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Ken, regarding what you just heard there, I mean, first of all, do you have any initial reactions to that presentation? Do you think that Dominion has a good case here and is likely to actually end up in court?
I do think they have an unusually strong case. Normally in defamation cases surrounding politics or all sorts of issues that make it tough. The statements are more likely to be hyperbole and rhetoric and less likely to be a provably false statement of fact. The types of discussions are the most protected by the First Amendment. But here you've got so many provably false statements of fact that are just completely divorced from reality. And you've got conduct that is just so clearly ignoring reality that I think it's a very unusually strong political speech defamation case. And he clearly knows exactly what he's doing and has given thought to the Streisand effect. And I think he's right. I mean, sooner or later, it's a bet the company case where it doesn't matter if you also encourage bad attention, if the existing bad attention is so bad that it ruins your company. It would not surprise me at all to see this actually go to litigation. I think that you see some news sources out there, as you alluded to, coming forward with sort of semi-quasi retractions. But I don't think that Sidney Powell or other people are going to be doing that. And I think that's inevitably going to lead to some exciting defamation litigation that we will get to cover.
Ben Smith has a column in the New York Times this Sunday about the likelihood of lawsuits against these media outlets that have run with these allegations. And one thing they teach you in legal training as a journalist is that simply reporting that somebody else is making an allegation can expose you and your employer to defamation liability, if you knew or should have known that the allegation was false. It's not simply a defense to say, well, I was just reporting what so-and-so said. Now, if it's in a court document, you are likely to have particular protections for reporting on it, but that's not what applies here. And so that's where the real deep pockets here could be, right? I don't know what Sidney Powell's wealth is, but I assume that if you're really trying to get serious damages for defamation here, the things you want to sue are the big corporations that ran with this story.
Yes, although you have to ask with someone like Dominion or Smartmatic whether the goal is to get money to make up for your loss or repair your reputation through the process. So whether you really want to force people to roll over and show their belly and publicly defeat them in a way that you can then soothe clients so that they'll still use your services because you've so conclusively defeated these allegations they've made. Yes, the money would be nice too, because if you lose business, then you're going to be on the back foot on that. But that's, that I would think, going to be their main focus.
Well, I mean, isn't the money important, especially in a situation like this, where it seems like you might be able to demonstrate really large damages, you might be able to seek punitive damages? I would think that the money would be more than just symbolism in a case like this, even for a large corporation.
Well, it's more than symbolism, but if you're going to litigate the whole thing, the money can be a long way down the road. And so it's often not sustainable to think the way we're going to make this business survive is to litigate this until we get money. The shorter term goal is often we have to get out there to get the right message out there and show that this is conclusively false.
Let's take a quick break, and then Ken and I will be back to talk about shell companies and campaign funds and answer your questions about the president's pardon power. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. Back again with All the President's Lawyers, I'm Josh Barrow. Ken White is my co-host, criminal defense attorney, and a former federal prosecutor. My colleagues at Business Insider have this interesting story about a shell company that spent much of the Trump campaign's money during the course of the campaign, noting that Jared Kushner was involved in the creation of this company. And so the part of the issue when you have a company like this as an intermediary is that the public reporting that we get about how campaigns spend their money, it's not really clear what they're spending the money on because it's just payments to this company. And then the company, I mean, we know, for example, that it was paying salaries to Eric Trump's wife and to Donald Trump Jr.'s girlfriend. But there's a lack of transparency about where the money is actually going. And then when you combine that with the Trump family involvement in the company, I guess there's this question of whether the funds were used properly. But I guess, first of all, is there anything necessarily illegal about this? The story also knows that the Romney campaign used a structure like this. And it's normal in any case for campaigns to buy their ads through third parties. So you don't see on the disbursement, you know, money to this television station and that television station. You give the money to an ad buyer, you don't see what percentage commission the ad buyer is taking on it. So there's already a lot of this stuff that is not necessarily transparent. So is it untoward that the Trump campaign was untransparent in this specific way?
No, it's not unusual. You could say that it's unfortunate, but it's unfortunate in a broad way that implicates a lot of campaigns. The problem is you have this really complicated mix of different types of structures that have money to use on campaigns. You've got the campaigns themselves, which have restrictions like, you know, you can't use this money for personal purposes. You've got PACs and super PACs and leadership PACs, which have completely different requirements. And then again, you have these new structures where the campaign sends the money to do things for the campaign. And it can be very difficult to determine whether that's being used as a way to evade the restriction that says that you can't use campaign money for personal purposes. You know, that's the sort of thing that United States Congressman Duncan Hunter got in trouble with and federally charged with.
We have a question from a listener, and we're going to do a whole bunch of listener questions on this show. Patrick wrote in and said that President Trump has supposedly raised many dollars in political contributions, he assumes, for a run in 2024. I would note that there's been some news reporting that the president's maybe a little less enthusiastic about that, but he could still have campaign entities looking toward a run in 2024, even if he doesn't ultimately run.
President Trump has supposedly raised many dollars in political contributions for, I assume, a run in 2024. However, he has in the past used charity as another means of funneling cash to his organization. I suspect that he'll use this money for other purposes, his upcoming bill on payments to his debt, for example. What are the limitations he must follow in political contributions? And do donors have any standing to bring lawsuits against them if they find the money is not used for what it was given for? What are the legal ramifications in using political contributions for personal enrichment?
So Patrick there actually asks about civil liability, but I guess let's start with the criminal question first. You're not allowed to use your campaign for personal purposes. How is that defined? If the president holds a bunch of events at his properties and otherwise directs business to his personal entities, puts members of his family on the payroll, how is that determined whether that's personal enrichment versus just, you know, paying a fee for a service if he really does have the event at Trump National Bedminster or whatever? How difficult would it be to make a case that the rates paid were unreasonable or something such that this really was just a transfer to himself and not a bona fide campaign activity?
No, it would be a hard case. I mean, the FEC has guidelines and establishes some things as clearly per se personal expenses. And that's like, you know, paying for your health insurance or groceries or things like that. Some things that are per se okay, that's like buying ads and things like that, and some things that can be gray areas. And those salaries and things can be gray areas when they benefit a family member or when you're renting something that benefits you. I think it would be tough to prove in a criminal context because of the necessity of proving in the campaign finance context, proving that you knew that you were doing something wrong, which normally you don't have to do in the law. So those aren't easy cases to make. But I think if you found egregious enough examples where things were done that were much more expensive and less expensive, more convenient alternatives were passed by, that could really be something that might rise to a criminal level.
And what about civil liability? Now, I assume the first barrier would be that the donors would have to feel aggrieved. And most Trump donors seem pretty enthusiastic about Donald Trump, and I think are unlikely to see themselves as victims of a fraud and to sue him. But suppose they did. Would they have any sort of claim that their campaign donations had been misspent?
Well, you know, they need to read the back of the ticket, Josh. Most of these things that Trump is setting up now after the election have disclaimers that make it pretty clear that this money can flow to various PACs and be used for a wide variety of purposes. So if it's just going to some place that it said it might go to, then there is no potential lawsuit there. Generally, campaigns are fairly careful in having fine print somewhere on the website when you click on donate, with lots of ifs and buts to cover them. Now, if people were making donations to the campaign itself, then there would be some limitations, like not putting it for personal spending. But if you have something like a so-called leadership PAC, and if it's disclosed as a leadership PAC, then that can be used for nearly anything. I mean, you can use that to fly Trump around the country and put him up at ritzy hotels and pay for good food while he goes and visits other politicians. There are few restrictions on it then. With respect to lawsuits, I think it would be very difficult to prevail in any of them unless it were something fraudulent on the level of like what's being alleged against Steve Bannon, when the allegation is people were told the money is going to be used only for this purpose, and in fact, the money was used for personal purposes.
There are also these news stories. Greg writes in about this, about Trump going to cities to campaign, and then the city or the county or whoever sends him a bill for all of the public safety costs to provide security and such things for the rally, and then Trump stiffing these cities and not paying these bills. And so Greg asks, could they band together and form a lawsuit against the Trump campaign for non-payment? He wants to know if it would be a class action. I assume that there aren't that many of these cities that they could file as direct action, even if there were several of them. But in any case, are they? Is there liability to these cities? Because I it's never been clear to me the extent to which these bills are actual legal obligations, or they are suggestions that by custom the campaigns pay to cover these costs because it feels kind of unreasonable to impose all this cost on a place that you go to campaign. But I mean, can the government actually bill you for coming somewhere in order to engage in speech and political activity? Because it seems like that could lead to some bad places. What if you had a liberal jurisdiction that basically told the president, hey, if you want to come here, we're going to send $3 million worth of police and public safety because we think that's necessary and it could actually be used as a way to restrict speech?
That's exactly right. There are First Amendment implications, and they've come up more in the context of protests and having to have security for protests, but they should apply with equal force to political rallies. So what the Supreme Court has said is that you can't have a system where the amount that can be charged can be purely discretionary with the city and based on the popularity or unpopularity of the message. That's called a heckler's veto, where the number of people who are going to be there threatening you can, in effect, force you off the stage because it's too expensive. So if the system in place is one at which the city gets to decide how much police protection you need and therefore gets to decide how much it's going to charge you based on the popularity or lack of popularity of your message, that is probably unconstitutional. And that's mostly been litigated, again, in the context of protests. But here's the thing. This whole area is a real mess. The reason is all sorts of campaigns, Republican and Democrat, conservative and liberal, routinely don't pay these things. In addition, sometimes there are agreements to pay and sometimes there are not. Sometimes there are local ordinances permitting them to charge and sometimes they're not. So a lot of the time there's really a gray area about whether or not it was like a suggested donation for the impact you had on the local police or some sort of legal obligation. And for the most part, that has not been litigated to a conclusion that's created good precedent, mostly because no one wants to, you know, litigate with politicians if they can avoid it. And often there's no money at the end of the rainbow anyway if it's a losing politician. So this is something that happens all the time. Cities complain about it all the time. And yet there's just a patchwork across the country of ones that do it, ones that send a bill, ones that don't, ones that make you sign a contract first, ones that don't, and so forth.
Speaking of security, Carol from Boston has a question.
This is Carol from Boston. And my question has to do with Secret Service. coverage and the cost of that. I understand that the president and his family have incurred extremely high Secret Service costs, often in ways that benefit Trump's personal businesses. What, if any, limit will there be to Secret Service protection and spending post-presidency? Will all his family members continue to be protected indefinitely? Is he free to continue to use Secret Service resources for his personal benefit? And are there any limits in law or in policy? Thank you.
It's a good question, Josh. So here's where the law currently is. When you're president and vice president, you and your immediate family, which includes your kids, get Secret Service protection. After you're no longer president, when you're a former president or vice president, then it's just you and any kids under 16. So in this case, Trump's elder children will not be entitled to Secret Service protection after he's no longer president. He will be. And it's not so much written into the law as a limit on how much it costs as it is a limit on who's being protected. So the Secret Service is going to spend as much as the Secret Service needs to spend to carry out its mission of protecting Trump. And so if he travels a whole lot, that's going to be more expensive. Or if he goes to places that are really difficult to protect him, that's going to be more expensive. But there's no like magic number where he hits it and then he's out of protection. There used to be a 10-year limit for former presidents, but that was changed some years back during the general post 9/11 concern about security.
Carol also has a very Trump-specific question about Secret Service protection.
And as a follow-up question, what if former President Trump is incarcerated or members of his family for misdeeds that may come to light or be pursued legally after his term in office ends? Thank you.
I'm not sure this is a question that's ever come up before. Does the Secret Service follow you to prison?
Well, this is a question that has been wishcast many times, but has never, in fact, happened. And practically speaking, if something like this happened, if someone who were entitled to Secret Service protection were in prison, then I imagine the Secret Service would work it out with the Bureau of Prisons, probably with some form of solitary confinement and segregated housing. But I don't think that you would be having, you know, Special Agent Jones and Special Agent Smith as your cellies.
So, of course, Trump would like to avoid that outcome. And I think some people may overestimate the likelihood of that outcome, even if he does not pardon himself. But we have some questions about what he might do before he leaves office in order to shield himself and his family from investigation and prosecution.
Can you talk a little bit about how the U.S. attorneys are likely to think about investigating and or prosecuting the Trump kids, political appointees, or others associated with the administration? For example, will they have discretion to start investigations without DOJ approval, or will they wait for a neutral organization, such as an IG office, to refer a matter to them so they have a little bit of cover? It feels like the norm would be not to aggressively pursue these to avoid a tit-for-tat investigation every time the administration changes. But based on some of the news stories, the potential this time around seems considerably higher. Thanks.
So, Ken, where are these decisions made? If there are people in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York who want to bring charges against Trump or his kids and that they're not blocked by a pardon, will they just sort of do that on their own authority?
The norm is no, not the way it's being described. So the norm is that investigative agencies bring cases to the U.S. Attorney's Office, not that lawyers in the U.S. Attorney's Office think up cases and then get investigators to go investigate them. So the norm is that the, you know, the Inspector General or the FBI or Secret Service, whoever brings a case to you, and then you run the investigation. It would be norm breaking for the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District to suddenly say, hey, I think we should launch an investigation into this thing. So there have obviously already been federal investigations, and those will probably persist into the new administration, and those could be the pad from which to launch further proceedings. Once that happens, it is the norm for U.S. attorneys' offices to be cautious, some would say overcautious, in going after politicians, just because of the appearance of partiality and because they tend to be a complete train wreck of a case. There are some restrictions on what you can do. You have to get, for instance, a higher level Department of Justice approval to do a wiretap on a politician than you do on a drug dealer. And there can be other limits on the types of information gathering methods you use against people who are or have been federal or state officials. Ultimately, though, the real decision will be made by the U.S. Attorney's offices, almost certainly practically in consultation with Maine Justice.
And so when you say consultation with Maine Justice, does that mean consultation with the Attorney General?
For something like this, yeah. Typically, something like the decision to go after like a congressman or a senator or something like that is going to go all the way up to the Attorney General, and they're going to be read into it. And that's just a matter of custom and practice and them wanting to know what's going on more than it is of specific Department of Justice regulation.
Although when there was an investigation into Hillary Clinton while she was a candidate for president, there was a desire by Maine Justice, by Loretta Lynch, then the Attorney General, to be seen as not making those decisions. And Lynch announced, and I think everyone pretty much thinks this was a mistake in retrospect, that she wouldn't make that decision, that she would take whatever recommendation the FBI director made, which is not the usual process, and which put James Comey in a very awkward position, which he proceeded to handle very poorly. But that pressure that Lynch felt that, you know, this is obviously a political thing and it would be better for her to be seen as not making these sorts of decisions, I imagine that might apply to Biden's attorney general. So even though normally something this high profile would come up that high, might the attorney general look for a way to avoid actually being the decider?
Well, sure. You have to understand the distinction between making the decision and being consulted on the decision. So Department of Justice has a lot of regulations where basically you have to notify somebody higher up you're doing this or consult with them before doing it. And I think that would be the practice. It would not be an explicit, ask the attorney general, we want to do this. Is that okay? It's go to the attorney general, probably first a deputy attorney general, and say, this is our plan, this is our evidence, this is what we propose to do, do you have any questions? And get consultation and input and then proceed.
We had a lot of questions about the limitations that exist on the president's pardon power. First, David Scher asked, can the president pardon a corporation?
That's an interesting question, and I think the consensus is probably yes. The Constitution doesn't say anything about pardoning people. It says something about pardoning federal offenses. So if a corporation faces federal charges and the president can pardon federal offenses, I don't see why the president couldn't do that, certainly given how broadly the pardon power is construed by courts.
One thing that we've noted frequently is the president cannot pardon offenses against states, that he can only pardon federal offenses. But Heath Waddingham asks, can the president pardon a crime against the laws of the District of Columbia?
Excellent question, because the laws of the District of Columbia, the question is, well, are those laws of the United States the way the pardon clause means? The answer is that crimes in the district against district law have on rare occasions been pardoned. So presidents have asserted that power. There is some controversy over whether that's correct and whether a violation of the DC code is a crime against the United States. But practically speaking, it has been done.
Dave writes in to ask whether a president can undo a pardon in the way that the president can undo an executive order that was issued by a previous president.
I've got a question regarding Trump pardoning himself and issuing general pardons without naming specific crimes. For example, a pardon for Ivanka for any crimes committed during the Trump term of office without naming a particular crime. While it sounds like such pardons wouldn't necessarily hold up to court challenge, Ken seemed to think such pardons would act as a significant deterrent to a Biden DOJ pursuing prosecutions against bad actors. Could the incoming Biden administration mitigate this issue with an executive order that says something to the effect that non-specific pardons are to be treated as non-operational by the DOJ, basically an unpardon from the executive branch? Thanks. Love the show.
That's not anything that a president has tried to do, but there's no basis to think that a president could. It's self-executing. The pardon wipes it out. And I think an argument would be that, first of all, the president, in effect, trying to reinstate charges against somebody would be something like a bill of attainder by Congress. It would be, trying to make someone a criminal and singling them out and unconstitutional. It would arguably also be a situation of double jeopardy. So no, there's nothing in the Constitution saying that the president can reverse a pardon or take back a pardon once another one has given it.
But that assumes that the pardon is a pardon of an offense that was convicted or at least charged. What if it's one of these blanket pardons that doesn't apply to any specific crime or any specific charge? If you sought to reverse that pardon, I can imagine other reasons why the reversal would not be valid. But it doesn't seem to me like that would create these double jeopardy or bill of attainder issues.
Well, sure. If there hasn't yet been a jury impaneled, then it's not going to be double jeopardy. But there's nothing in the text of the pardon clause that says that a different president can take it back. And the history of pardons is that they're self-executing once accepted by the person. So there's no indication that the president has that sort of power to reinstate.
What about, we've talked about how some of these pardons, there's some dispute about exactly what they mean when they have certain blanket language. Could a new president try to clarify a pardon that was issued by a previous president? Could the Office of Legal Counsel issue a memo saying what is and is not actually covered by one of these pardons that covers not just specific offenses, but tries to create some category of offenses that are covered?
Well, all they could really do, I think, is to state what the Justice Department's position is on the meaning of the pardon. So let's say there's some controversy about General Flynn's pardon, which is confusingly written, and the Biden Justice Department issues a letter saying this is how we interpret it. That's not going to get tested unless somebody charges Flynn with a crime and he tries to assert that pardon as a defense. And then it's going to be worked out by some long-suffering federal judge who's going to have to determine, was this pardoned or not? Do I find this interpretation by the Justice Department persuasive? But it's not a unquestionable power of the Justice Department to simply say this is what it means.
And what if the president pardons himself? My understanding is there is a memo from the Nixon era from the Office of Legal Counsel saying, like, we don't think the president can pardon himself. So suppose Trump sought to issue a self-pardon. Could the Biden Office of Legal Counsel, might they issue a memo basically saying that that pardon is invalid? And then would that only be tested if they then tried to bring charges against Trump? Or could Trump file a lawsuit, try to seek a declaratory judgment saying, no, my pardon is valid?
I don't think he could file a declaratory lawsuit because it would not be ripe. If there are no charges against him, then it's purely speculation that there ever would be. Then no, he doesn't have that right. He doesn't have standing, in effect, to go after it. But yes, if he were then charged, it would be up to the federal judge and likely all the way to the Supreme Court to determine which Office of Legal Counsel letter was right. The Nixon era one, which frankly does not have a lot of analysis and kind of just says, come on, obviously, or the new one and whatever it said.
Let's take one more break. And after this, Ken and I will answer a question about Mar-a-Lago and why some of President Trump's neighbors in Palm Beach say he can't just move back in after he leaves the White House. And we'll answer some big questions about what happens next to Michael Avenatti, Cyrus Vance, E. Jean Carroll, and our show. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. Back again with All the President's Lawyers, I'm Josh Barrow. Ken White is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney and a former federal prosecutor. I have a few more listener questions about the future. Judy Carey would like to know about where the president is going to go after January 20th. And this isn't really a question about him refusing to leave the White House. She says, when he made his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach a club, he agreed with the town of Palm Beach that it would no longer be considered a residence. And furthermore, that neither he nor a club member could reside there for more than 3 weeks per year. Many of his neighbors are already upset by his use agreement violations, and the Palm Beach Town Council and the mayor are under pressure to enforce the rules. What chance, if any, do you think they have of being successful in running him off the island? Judy notes this question is interesting to her because she lives in Jupiter, about 30 miles north of Palm Beach. She also says she loves listening to our podcast. Thanks for making some sense out of all the crazy. Thank you, Judy. We really appreciate that. So, Ken, this zoning issue. Is Donald Trump allowed to live at Mar-a-Lago where he is registered to vote?
Well, thank you for asking, Josh, because I am, as you know, an expert in Florida land use law. So to undertake this, rather than stuff Christmas cards last night, I read the 1993 use agreement between Palm Beach and Donald Trump, because this is the business I've chosen. And sure enough, there is this agreement that when Trump turned this place into a club, he agreed to a whole bunch of restrictions, some of which include that no one can live there for more than 7 days at a time, non-sequentially, as a club member. Also, there cannot be animal circuses. Interesting point, but potentially important. They are going to argue that this clearly shows that it was being given up as a private residence and that it prohibits it being used for full-time occupation by anyone, whether or not they're a club member. He's going to have some defenses. I think he'd have an easier time if he wanted to turn it back to an entirely private residence rather than keeping it both a club and a private residence, because there's a way it can revert back under the language of the agreement. But here's the thing. This may be more about power and how litigation goes than it is about the exact language of the agreement. Zoning disputes are notorious for being long and drawn out. Often it's a question of whether or not the town has the resources to litigate it the way it would need to be litigated. And I think a perfectly plausible, even likely outcome would be that basically Palm Beach can't afford to litigate this as much as Trump is willing to litigate it, to do what he
really
wants
to do. Really, Palm Beach is very wealthy.
Do they have however millions of dollars it's going to take to litigate this lying around, and do they want to spend it? And will that be politically popular? So I think it's not the foregone conclusion that some critics think it is, that he's going to be successfully prohibited, although the town certainly has a very plausible agreement-based argument that he shouldn't be able to use it as a residence.
We have another question from Mick in Chicago.
Hello, Josh and Ken. Longtime listener, first-time caller. President Trump, with assistance from a Republican-controlled Senate, has installed a significant number of federal judges. In the past, you've argued that the trust and power invested in a lifetime appointment to the bench would serve to temper the partisan impulses of those installed. But you also initially argued Bill Barr would be a conservative traditionalist, and later stated your assessment was off once he started indulging in more partisan activity. So my big picture question is this. What impacts of these judicial appointments do you foresee? Do you stand by your assessment that these judges will be tempered by the bench, or have they shown signs of indulging and legitimizing pet conservative causes? Thanks for your input, Mick.
Yeah, they're going to be throwing that bar thing in my face for the rest of time, aren't they? Okay, I deserve that. So, yes, I've said in the past a couple of things. One is that the federal bench has a way of moving people towards a center. Making them into extreme partisans. And I think we have seen some of that in this election litigation. We have seen some Trump appointees who were, before their appointment, seen as very conservative, very thoroughly shut down Trump litigation. It has not been a close thing either. We have seen over the last few years some judges act in a very conservative way. I would say less in a Trump conservative way. That is, less in a sort of flamboyant, abusive, and nonsensical way, more in a traditional mainline conservative Federalist Society way. But we've seen both. We've seen a mix. And that's going to be the truth with any set of judges. So yeah, I continue to maintain that I think it's going to be a mixed bag. There will be some extreme ideologues who will be notorious. There'll be some who are simply mainline conservative. Some will be mellowed by the experience. And one thing you have to remember, Josh, is a significant number are going to retire to go get big bucks, because once you've been a federal judge, you can really write your ticket. You can go out and do mediation and arbitration at ludicrous rates. You can go become of counsel at giant firms that will pay you huge amounts of money. So there's always going to be this iron call of money to get some of these people off the bench.
I guess one other thing in terms of Trumpy behavior is there were, not in the election litigation where Trump has lost over and over, but there were some other lawsuits that produced some pretty questionable decisions at the appellate level. And people were wondering about the extent to which appellate judges might have been auditioning to be appointed to the Supreme Court by Donald Trump, or maybe district judges who want to be appointed to an appellate court. And so that pressure presumably should abate with Trump not president anymore. Those judges might try to signal how conservative they are to appeal to a conservative president, but you wouldn't have this specific issue of a president who's mired in all sorts of weird litigation that might come before you.
Well, exactly. Trump has been an unusually litigation-intensive president on every level. And now, even more so during this election contest season. But really, I mean, the appellate judges, too, with a few exceptions, have pretty much held to traditional rule of law type values. And that's been mostly heartening. I think the weirdest takes we've gotten have been the ones we talked about, which were not from federal judges, but from the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So for the most part, federal appellate judges have been shooting right down the middle.
We have another question about Rule 11.
Hi, Josh and Ken. I'm a 1L, and I'm taking my civil procedure final this week. One subject that we covered this semester was Rule 11 sanctions, which may be imposed when a party presents a pleading or other paper that is not warranted by existing law or by a non-frivolous argument for extending, modifying, or reversing existing law or for establishing new law, or they make factual contentions that are unsupported by evidence or not likely to be supported by evidence. It would seem like some of the complaints filed by the Trump campaign and others in recent weeks seeking to discredit the election results would meet this standard, but I haven't heard anything about judges issuing sanctions against attorneys in those suits. Am I being overly optimistic to think that Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, and their ilk will be slapped with sanctions for trying to undermine American democracy? Thanks. Love the show.
So, I have something to tell our friend who's a 1L, and he should sit down because it's going to make him sad. The truth is that in our system, in our federal system, judges fairly rarely sanction very sanctionable conduct. He's absolutely right that objectively speaking, most, if not all, of these election lawsuits have been sanctionable. They have been objectively bogus in both factually and legally. But even when lawsuits are sanctionable, federal judges rarely use the sanction power. So far, you know, the judges could have, in all of these cases, on their own accord, levied Rule 11 sanctions. They'd have to give the side a chance to respond, but they could have done it. And any of the parties could have moved for Rule 11 sanctions. But it's a headache. It's a process. And a lot of the time, the judges just don't want to go through it. They don't want to take the trouble. And they see getting a quick substantive ruling against the frivolous party as the best way to deal with bad conduct rather than the monetary penalty. Now, some judges are better with it than others, but as a rule, you'll find most lawyers frustrated by the reluctance of federal judges to issue sanctions when they're warranted.
Finally, before we go, we're entering a new year and we're about to enter a new presidency. And we've been so consumed with Donald Trump and this cast of characters around him that people are wondering about, you know, some of the supporting characters that we've seen in this. What's going to become of them in a few weeks when this administration is over? So let's start first with Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance. He has been investigating Trump's businesses. There's this litigation over a subpoena that he's been trying to enforce against Donald Trump's accounting firm. What's going to happen to Vance and to Donald Trump's efforts to stymie Vance's investigation when Trump is no longer president?
Well, I think Vance is going to have to put up or shut up. There's been all of this wish casting and rumors swirling around that he has the goods. And that just as soon as Trump's no longer president, he's going to be able to go after him, that he's waiting just so he doesn't have to litigate the issue of whether you're allowed to, a state court is allowed to bring criminal charges against a sitting president. And I suppose we'll find out if there's any there. If there is, I think we can expect more grand jury proceedings and maybe even search warrants, maybe even criminal charges. But I think sooner or later, he's going to actually have to make it something more than talk.
How about E. Jean Carroll, who is suing the president for defamation? E. Jean Carroll accuses the president of having raped her in the 1990s. The president denied her allegation in very crude terms. And then she sued him for defamation, saying that he falsely accused her of lying about this. And then one of the key legal issues in this case has been the assertion of the Department of Justice that the president denied this allegation in his official capacity as president, and therefore that the federal government should step in as the defendant in this case, which would lead to the case's dismissal because the government cannot be sued for defamation. So the judge has been skeptical of that argument. What's going to become of this case when we have a new Justice Department leadership that may not be so eager to try to stand in for Donald Trump here?
Well, that's a good question, because part of what's going on is that this judge has rejected the idea that the federal government can step in. Trump is appealing that, and he has asked the judge to stay discovery, to stay the case during the appeal. E. Jean Carroll, of course, is vigorously opposing that, and I think it's unlikely that this district court judge is going to do it. And then on January 20th, who knows what the Justice Department is going to do? You're going to have these competing interests on the one hand of not continuing to carry water for Trump and promote a very distasteful legal position. On the other hand, the Justice Department's position is going to be that they want broad discretion to be able to step into cases against presidents. And that's for Biden's good as much as it is for Trump's good. So I'm not entirely sure which way they're going to make this call, whether they're going to make it that they don't want to be involved in this particular case anymore, or whether institutionally they feel they have to be involved to protect the principle about suing the president. But E. Jean Carroll is going to be okay. She right now is taunting Trump by basically offering to agree to stay discovery if he'll give a DNA test so they can test that against the sample she claims to have on her jacket. And I think she will continue to be a thorn and a very effective one in Donald Trump's side.
How about Michael Avenatti? What's going to become of him?
He's going to do prison time. And how much is yet to be determined, but he's going to be sentenced in that case where he shrewdly decided to try to blackmail one of the biggest corporations in the United States and one of the most powerful law firms in the United States. And then he's still got two other cases in the hopper where he is entirely likely to be convicted. So he is not looking at anything happy over the next decade.
Finally, people want to know what's going to happen to us, Ken. What does it mean for us, hosts of a Donald Trump legal problems themed podcast, when Donald Trump seeks to be president? What becomes of us?
Well, Josh, we're not going anywhere. Here's the thing. Donald Trump is going to continue to have legal issues. Many of those legal issues are going to be entangled with Biden administration legal issues. And you know what? Joe Biden's going to have legal issues. He's going to have issues over, for instance, whether or not he wants a special prosecutor to handle the investigation against his son Hunter into tax issues. He's going to have any number of issues when Republican senators might try to start investigations of him to continue some of the narratives they've pushed over the last few years. And he's going to do things that are wrong. He's going to break the law. All presidents do, and they wind up in court. And we're going to be talking about his lawyers and the colorful characters that will surround them, just like they've surrounded Trump, for as long as it keeps happening.
Yeah, so we're not going anywhere. We will have some news for you in a few weeks. The show's going to get a new name, a very exciting new name. And the focus of the show may shift a little bit. We're going to feel some things out and try some things out. And if there are things that you want to hear about, please, as always, reach out to us. Give us your ideas about what we should do. But we'll be here as the president continues to have lawyers and legal problems. But I think that's a good place for us to leave it for this week and this year. Ken, as always, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh. Always a pleasure.
Again, if you have those questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, or you just have advice for us as we try to figure out what to do with our lives, please send that to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd and Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back in January with more All the President's Lawyers.